I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. His story begins in small-town Kansas and remote villages of western Kenya, and ends with him in the White House. Barack Obama's story is an unlikely one for an American president and a compelling tale of identity, politics, and power. This hour, David Marinus shares with us his new biography of America's first African-American president. From his parents' tumultuous marriage to his own struggles with his identity, Obama's path to the White House is a powerful and controversial American story. Find out on Up to Date after this hour's news. To Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. There are so many insights into President Barack Obama in David Marinus's new book on the president's family and early years. Insights like Obama's great-grandmother committing suicide in a garage in Topeka, or the lack of clues that Barry Obama would one day become a politician, or high school classmates in Hawaii who recall Obama's cool exterior masking an interior that was seething and searching. This is a book that critics say that neither makes a case for the president's re-election or suggests that re-election would be a mistake. It's just the story of a young man, his family, and roots that extend from Kansas to Hawaii to Indonesia and to Kenya. It is, David Marinus concludes, an absolute marvel that Barack Obama ever became president to begin with. David Marinus' new book is Barack Obama, The Story. He's an associate editor at The Washington Post and the author of critically acclaimed books on Bill Clinton, Vince Lombardi, and Roberto Clemente. He's also a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and he joins us on the line this morning from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. David, so nice to have you. Good morning.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning.
Well, is this book an argument for or against the president's reelection? What's your take on that?
Neither, and nor was that ever its intent. It's just an attempt to explain Barack Obama and the world from which he came. I'm not a polemicist. I don't write from an ideological perspective. Obviously, like all human beings, I have my own politics, but that's not what this book is about. So I think that overall, if people read this book, they'll have a better understanding for why he does what he does. And the forces that shaped him.
You know, this book begins with an episode in Topeka, of all places, that I really knew nothing about. It involves Barack Obama's great-grandmother and her suicide in an auto garage in the 1100 block of 6th Avenue. David, what happened there, and why was it so pivotal in the life of the president's family?
Well, this was his great-grandmother, Ruth Armour Dunham, who had been married when she was 15 and had an unhappy marriage.
Yeah.
And it was Thanksgiving Day, 1926, when her husband and their two children drove down to Malvern, Kansas, to have Thanksgiving with some relatives. And she was in a terrible fight with her husband and drove back to Topeka. She thought with justification that he was a womanizer and not treating her well. And she went to their house and walked a block and a half to 6th Avenue to a drugstore where she talked the pharmacist into giving her some strychnine, which she said she was going to use because a dog had been hit by a car and she wanted to put it out of its misery. In fact, it was herself that she was putting out of her misery at age 26. And it was because of her suicide that one of her sons, or both of her sons, Ralph and Stanley, but Stanley turned out to be the grandfather of President Obama, moved back to El Dorado, Kansas, in south central Kansas, to live with their grandparents. And that move back to El Dorado set in motion the events that would lead to the creation of Barack Obama.
You know, there's another moment early on in this book in which you describe your own visit to Jakarta and the home of the future president who then went by the name of Barry Sotoro. You describe
Yes.
this neighborhood, and then you write, "I could not help but be overwhelmed by how utterly improbable it was that Barry Sotoro had made his way to the White House. Tell us about that neighborhood in Jakarta that brought you to that conclusion.
Well, that's one of the reasons that my motto is go there, wherever there is, when I'm writing a book, because there's so much of the sensibility of a place that you can only get by walking the streets and really feeling it in the shoes of the person you're writing about. So this is the Mentang Dalam neighborhood in South Jakarta. It's changed, obviously, over the course of the many years since Barry Satoro, as a 7- and 8-year-old, lived there. But in some senses, things haven't changed. It's narrow alleyways. You feel the sounds of the street vendors and the smells of the street food and the neighborhood boys playing in the area. It's I would call it middle class by Indonesian standards, but very, very condensed and just the sensibility that one got by going there, going to the local school, and realizing that Barry Satoro was completely immersed in that culture. He wasn't a diplomat's kid going to the international school and living in the cocoon of a Western culture, but thrown in entirely. He had to make his own way, learn Bahasa Indonesia, the local language, survive with the local kids, most of whom thought that he was from another island in the great chain of archipelago of islands of Indonesia. They thought from his skin color that perhaps he was from Ambon, where there are darker-skinned peoples. So he had to adjust to all of that. And just walking those streets and those alleyways and thinking about what an improbable journey it was from Barry Satoro to President Obama.
And Barry Satoro didn't really like it there, did he?
Well, it was everything was different and alien, and I'm sure he liked some parts of it as a kid, but it was a little bit intimidating for him. What happened was that once he came back to Honolulu to be with his grandparents, he didn't want to go back to Indonesia again when his mother went back after getting her graduate degree and launching her career as an anthropologist.
You know, this book is so much about locations, as you just mentioned, and here's another one. You also visited Chicago and went into the office of the Reverend Elvin Love of the Lilydale First Baptist Church, who met Barack Obama, community organizer, in 1985. Obama wanted 15 minutes of the Reverend's time, but the two wound up talking for a whole lot longer. What did the Reverend Elvin Love recall from that meeting?
Well, he thought, first of all, that this skinny guy who came knocking on the door was just another street person looking for a handout, and then was introduced to Barack Obama, community organizer. They had a lot in common. They both had a certain sense of being outsiders. Reverend Love had spent much of his adolescence, childhood in Mississippi, and was adjusting to the streets of Chicago himself. And they also realized that they had common goals, that Reverend Love was trying to build his church and get it attached to that community of Roseland in south side of Chicago, and Barack Obama was starting to organize down there and needed the help of some of the preachers to get anything accomplished in terms of changing the lives of the poor residents of that area. So They developed a friendship then and there that day in 1985.
How effective of a community organizer was Barack Obama?
Well, community organizing by its very nature is a frustrating job.
Yeah, sure.
You lose most of the time. You're the powerless fighting against power. So in that sense, he, you know, in letters that I have that he wrote, he said that he was frustrated. At first, I think it was 95% of the time, and then it dropped to 80%. But nonetheless, he was a different type of organizer from most. His mentors said that the whole notion of organizing is to take action against people in power, and that Barack Obama was more of a conciliatory type and not confrontational, something that you've seen played out in this presidency to a certain degree. So in that sense, Jerry Kelman, who was one of his mentors, said he'd never seen anybody who was more deliberative and cautious. And yet, Kelman said, there was once in a while when Barack Obama would make a bold move after frustrating him by being so deliberate. So you see that played out in his presidency as well.
But this place, Chicago, obviously becomes very, very important to him because really for the first time in Barack Obama's life, he's found a home, right, David?
You know, I describe his journey as an arc toward home, starting in Honolulu where he never knew his father, where his mother, for all of the love and everything else that she inculcated into him, was not around much during his adolescence and high school years, where he was living with his great white grandparents. And then from then on, he's trying to search for his racial identity and for family. And in the end, he finds both of those when he arrives in Chicago for that first period from 1985 to 1988 when he was a community organizer. He's embraced by middle-aged and older black women on the South Side who sort of smother him in a way that he'd never felt before of family. So personally, finds him, even though he was born with black skin, he was not culturally African-American in any sense. He never knew his father. He was living in Hawaii with his white grandparents. And so he had to learn that aspect of it, and he really learned it and felt embraced by it in Chicago. And that's also, so personally, he found home there. And then on a sort of a career level as a politician, he started to study the uses of power when he got to Chicago and realized what he wanted to do with his life.
We're visiting with author David Marinus about his new book, Barack Obama, The Story. So then, to what extent, David, did Barack Obama raise himself, by and large?
Well, more than most people do. He really had to both find himself in terms of race and self-identity. And his mother, was with him when he was in Indonesia and for a couple of years in Honolulu, but they were apart a lot of the time after that. His grandfather, Stanley Dunham, the son of the woman who committed suicide in that Topeka garage, was sort of what I call a combination of Willie Loman and Walter Mitty. He always had great dreams that he couldn't realize, and he was a fantasizer of different sorts. And so young Barry realized that at an early age, that he couldn't rely on a real male role model. So to a large degree, he really did have to find his own way.
So how amazing is it then, at the end of the day, that Barack Obama sort of came out of all this, yeah, some people would say, as relatively normal as he appears to be?
I think that he worked at it very hard. In terms of his political rise, my study of a lot of politicians is that they do come out of various forms of dysfunction, and that's what drives them in various ways to achieve. So that part of it does not surprise me. But the fact that he came out of it relatively balanced, many politicians excel because of the imbalances in their life. And I think that Obama, from about the time he arrived at Occidental College at age 18 to the time he left Chicago for Harvard Law School, those 10 years, he worked pretty hard at trying to resolve the contradictions of his life and was fairly successful at doing so, to his benefit and to his trouble. I mean, he, in some ways, he doesn't need people the way that many great politicians do, like LBJ or Bill Clinton. And so that can cause people to not connect with him as much or think that he's aloof or whatever. And when, in fact, he doesn't have that drive, which can border on neuroses, to be around people and to always sort of be involved in transactional politics.
Now, that's a recurring theme in this book, Obama's aloofness and the distance he kept from others, even girlfriends. What was behind that?
I think what was behind it was a caution born of being biracial and cross-cultural. And some of it comes out of the geography of his life, both in Hawaii, where there's a saying, cool head, main thing, meaning just be cool, man, don't show too much, hold back. Indonesia culture is definitely like that. So his formative years were played out in places where that is just part of the culture. And also, I think, because of the circumstances of his life, trying to figure out how to negotiate in different worlds, black and white, leads to some of that as well.
The fact that he was apart from his mother for so much of his life and then not having much of a relationship at all with his father, how did he react to that? Was there, I mean, you would think of burning anger with a lot of people who are in a predicament like that.
Well, there was some anger, definitely directed towards both of them in different ways. Although his mother, I think there was also some guilt there on his part for being angry at her, because he came to understand, the difficult life that she had to overcome, having him, when she was only 18 years old and being such a smart and sardonic and worldly woman, trying to make her own way. She was not very good at picking her mates, either Barack Obama Sr. nor Lolo Santoro proved to be particularly helpful or strong with her. Obama Sr. was not only an alcoholic but abusive. So Barry, as he was called as a young man, never knew that father. So, of course, he carried the anger of being abandoned and not having that father figure. With his mother, it was more complicated. Sometimes he thought that she was naive and he had to protect her. Sometimes he thought she depended on him too much and was pulling away from her. I have letters and journal entries from his years in New York City where he talked about sort of his mother's dependence on him and how he was trying to pull away. It was complicated, but in the end, virtually all of the attributes that he carried with him for the better into politics came from that mother.
I was thinking that, his mother, Stanley Ann Dunham, died at 52 of cancer. And
yes.
I can only imagine that a biographer like yourself would have had so many questions for her had she lived.
When people ask me what person in this book would I most like to have interviewed, it was Stanley Ann Dunham.
Oh, I'm sure.
She was a complicated, really interesting woman would have so much to offer in terms of deepening my understanding of her son.
We'll talk about more of her in just a few minutes, but just getting back to his father for a moment, you also conclude that even though Barack had so little time with his dad, that maybe at the end of the day, that wasn't such a bad thing, given who he was, given how self-destructive he was, and given how abusive he very well might have been.
Yeah, I mean, that's difficult for an outsider to say, but my conclusion nonetheless is that Barack Obama was lucky he never lived with his father. When I was in Kenya, in Nairobi, I spent a full day interviewing Barack Obama Sr.'s third wife, Ruth Ndesanjo, who was also an American who married him and moved to Kenya after he had left. He and Ann Dunham had split up. And she told me some horrific stories about him, not only his drinking, but his physical abuse. Beating her physically and intimidating the children. And so I think that would have done Barack Obama no good, and he was lucky never to have lived with him.
David Marinus is our guest. His new book, Barack Obama, The Story. If you want to join our conversation about the upbringing and early life of our nation's president, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You compare him to another president that you wrote so well about a few years ago, Bill Clinton. With Clinton, you write, there was this continuous cycle of loss and recovery. He would be on top, and then he would essentially undermine himself again. With Obama, you saw something else again, and that is this continuing effort to do what you describe as avoiding life's traps. What do you mean by that?
Well, his whole life offered a number of traps for him. The first being born without, a father around, being born on an island, paradise in a sense, and possibly being trapped there thousands of miles away from the action. The trap of the dysfunction of his family, of his mother being gone a lot. The trap of being biracial and not really having a firm sense of self-identity for so long. And then various traps of politics and geography, including in Chicago, where one can easily be trapped in the racial politics of that city. all along the way, you see Barack Obama sort of analyzing the situation. That explains some of his caution, trying to figure out where the traps are and how he can get around them to get where he wants to go. And that really sort of has defined his life and, to some extent, his presidency.
Let's go back to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888. Mike from Lawrence, you're on with David Marinus. Good morning. Mike, you there? Mike had a question about whether you were able to, whether the president can claim any Cherokee ancestry. What about that?
Well, there is a claim on his mother's side. His grandmother was Madeline Payne, and her family were the McMurtries, and McCurries, I'm sorry. And there was some McCurries had said that there was Cherokee blood in that line. One of the McCurries did a genealogy and didn't find it. So it's an open question. I'm not sure, but many of the family members talked about it.
Well, speaking of genealogy, were you able to make any progress on the question of exactly where Barack Obama was born, David?
Well, I never thought that that was an issue, even though some people still do.
Yes.
August 4th, 1961 in Kapi'olani Medical Center in Honolulu. To believe anything else, you'd have to think that a conspiracy from 50 years ago included the Honolulu newspapers, which recorded his birth notice. Various people at the hospital who that week were talking about the oddity that Stanley had a baby, because Stanley was the first name of his mother. and finally, that the INS was involved, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which was tracking Barack Obama Sr., who was on a student visa from Kenya, and who the INS really didn't like. They thought he was a bigamist and a womanizer, and they were watching his every move during that period, so that if he had left or if anybody in the family had left, they never would have gotten back in the country. So all of it is every shred of evidence points in other directions.
You know, there's another difference between Obama and Bill Clinton that you raise here, and it's this idea that Clinton's political ambition was just so obvious, and with Obama it was so well hidden for so many years. I'm wondering, how could Barack Obama become president of this country and somehow, you know, not demonstrate a certain raw ambition that so many people these days associate with presidential candidates?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I mean, in one sense, he's a late bloomer, and then he bloomed awfully fast, you know. I mean, his rise from the Illinois Senate to the presidency is kind of breathtaking in the sense that it all happened in a decade, basically. But he showed very few inclinations before that. Clinton ran for every possible office in high school, so much that finally his principal had to come to him in his senior year and say, "Billy, we're sick of you dominating every election, so you can't run for president." And he said, "Okay, I'll run for class secretary," you know, which he did, and lost to a girl, which upset him, of course. Mm-hmm. But you know, you see none of that in Barry Obama's days at Punahou School, the prep school he went to in Honolulu. Mm-hmm. He ran for nothing. He was not part of many student organizations, if any. He just he played basketball. He was a good basketball player on the high school team, and he smoked dope. And that was really sort of his life in Honolulu in that period. In college at Occidental, he did meet some more intellectual classmates or older students there who sort of sparked something in him. They could see the first sense of feeling of destiny that he had, which in fact his mother had always told him he was special. But he, again, there, you know, he gave one speech. It was an anti-apartheid speech and a student rally. And he was kind of skeptical and cynical about it. Afterwards, he said he didn't think it made any difference. At Columbia, he really disappeared virtually. No one knew him there for the 2 years he went to school there. He was not actively involved in the Black Student Organization. He wrote a couple of articles for a student magazine, and that's about it. So it really happened late. Not until Chicago did he feel comfortable. And as a community organizer, he started studying the uses of power and how Harold Washington, the first African-American mayor there, was operating. And the competitive will was always there, but it didn't have a direction until mm-hmm. Chicago. And from there, you can see a straight line.
Well, are you going to write a sequel to this book? Because this book takes him through the college years. What's your plan going forward, or have you done what you wanted to do?
Well, in many ways, this was the book that obsessed me. But I do intend to write a second volume. I'm not going to do it in a rush. My interest has nothing to do with the elections, but with getting the story right. So there are a lot of documents that will come out later. And I didn't want to commit myself to a Robert Caro-like four-decade enterprise, although Caro is one of my heroes.
Oh, mine too.
I just think he's fabulous. First of all, I won't be around in 36 years. And secondly, there are other things that I'd like to write about as well. So I plan a second volume.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with David Marinus. Again, his new book, Barack Obama, The Story. We'll talk a little bit more about Mom and Dad, the Chum Gang, and this whole sense that Barack Obama, how desperate did he want to be a transformational president? I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our political pundits roundtable yesterday, you can find it and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. We're off tomorrow for the holiday, but join us on Thursday for a talk with Dr. Wes Crenshaw about teens and sex. This hour, we're visiting with David Marinus about his book, Barack Obama, The Story. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 or email us UpToDate at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. David joins us this morning from Madison, Wisconsin. And David, I think you're in Vilas Hall. That's my alma mater where the J School is up there, right?
Oh, no kidding. I did not know that. I absolutely am.
Yeah, yes. I think it was there when I was there, and lo and behold, it's still there, I guess. Yeah.
It might get torn down. Some of that sort of Eastern European architecture is finally leaving this campus. But studied here, you can easily get lost in this building.
You can. What an odd building it is, but what a beautiful, beautiful campus it is, and a beautiful place
totally.
To live for you. So good. Well, was it any surprise to you after all your research that Barack Obama desperately wanted to be a transformational president, you know, a president of great consequence?
Not too much of a surprise. You can see from the age of 21, he wrote a letter to one of his girlfriends where he talked about the various niches that many of his friends were falling into in life, and that he couldn't feel comfortable being narrowly set into any of them, and that for him to feel himself, he had to embrace it all. And so that notion of trying to embrace it all you can transfer that to a notion of wanting to be a great president, and not that brings its own dangers with it, but also an ambitious reach, which I think was there from the beginning.
And you can't help but think that, you know, with the economy in the shape that it was when he took over, that wasn't the kind of opportunity that he was looking forward to. He wanted a different kind of presidency. At least that's always been my sense.
Well, you know, the Onion newspaper, which also was founded here in Madison, Wisconsin, had a headline the day after he was elected that said, Black man elected to world's worst job. And in some sense, you know, he was handed a pretty difficult hand compared with some other presidencies, including Bill Clinton's, but every president ends up having to deal with completely unexpected events. You know, the campaigns are waged on certain issues, and then the presidency comes, and everything is turned upside down. It happens almost every time, and you have to deal with what you're dealt.
Let's turn to Obama's mother and father a little bit more. I mean, there's a phrase for Barack Obama's father that you use several times, and that is self-destructive. Why was he bent that way, and why would he prove so attractive to Obama's mother?
Well, he was a brilliant man who straddled almost centuries, in a sense, you know, coming out of Western Kenya, Luo Land out near Lake Victoria, where when he was a kid, life was quite different and not particularly westernized. And he was in the first wave of Kenyan scholars to reach the shores of America to prepare for the nation's independence and to study here. So he sort of was that sort of a bridge figure between very, very different cultures and ways of life. And that was disorienting to some extent. And then complicating that was the fact that he was an alcoholic and all of the difficulties that that brought. But he had a charisma to him that was very attractive to women, not just Stanley and Dunham, but many others. And so, you know, the explanations for that are beyond my ken, but mm-hmm. but we all know men like that, or women who are attracted to somewhat dangerous men. And I think his brilliance and charisma at the beginning would overcome the dangers that he brought.
Yeah, I don't think most folks really understand just how little time he spent with his son, David. I mean, it was really not much at all, right?
Yeah, in the memoir that Barack Obama wrote, he said that the family was together for about 2 years, and then Barack Obama Sr. Went off to graduate school at Harvard and couldn't afford to bring the family along. And that if he had taken a scholarship at the new school, they all could have come. That's the story that Barack's mother told him. And it was a protective mythology that was not the truth. They did not live together much at all, if at all. She left with young Barry about a month after he was born, went back to Seattle and started extension courses there and got herself back into good academic graces and came back to Hawaii to study only after Barack Sr. had left for Harvard. So the family really as a family did not exist.
And Obama's mother, Ann Dunham, you describe her as being afraid of smallness. What do you suggest with that?
You know, I think that's a theme that runs through that side of the family. Mm-hmm. Even Stanley Dunham was sort of an American searcher in a classic sense. Kansas was too small for him. He kept going out to California, not quite making it there, then to Washington State, to the Seattle area, and then on to Honolulu. And his daughter, Stanley Ann Dunham, had that same sensibility, except it was even deeper because she was more of an intellectual than her father was and was more interested in the wide world around her. And so she never wanted to be confined. And that's what took her not only to Honolulu, but to Indonesia, mm-hmm. Even further west. And life in different parts of the world. She spent much of her life traveling in the Asian subcontinent and in Indonesia and various third world places. And she never wanted to be confined to an average life.
You know, was she spacey? Was she naive? Because even her son used to accuse her of being naive. What's your take on that?
You know, I think that I think that he exaggerates that a bit to make his points in terms of race. And he thought she was too idealistic and didn't see the world as it was. And perhaps some of that is because she was his mother. And she was trying to protect him from the difficulties of the world as it is. And so that's a natural mother's protective reaction to things. And in fact, in her real life, in her professional life as an anthropologist and in microfinance later in Indonesia, dealing with a very male-dominated, sexist culture, an oppressive culture, really, in Indonesia in many ways. She was not naive. She knew the realities of the politics of that place and was fairly agile at dealing with it. So I think that You know, she was idealistic, but she was also a pragmatist, as are most people who deal in that world of NGOs in other places.
Was the president with her when she passed?
No, he was not, much to his later guilt and regret. His sister, Maya, was there and just got there in time, but Barack was in Chicago and perhaps misjudged how quickly she was going. But he did not get there until a couple of days later.
And she died where, David?
She died in Honolulu in a clinic near their house. She'd gone back from Indonesia in her final months when she was very sick with uterine cancer, and was actually sort of for much of that time in an apartment next to her mother's apartment in the Punahou Circle apartments in Honolulu.
David Marinus is our guest. Again, his book, Barack Obama, The Story, just out. Terrific book. Our phone number here to take your questions about our president, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, David, if you saw Barack Obama in high school, people thought, what, pretty cool guy, at least based on the outward appearance, but something else entirely going on inside? Or what's your sense?
Well, when you of all of the dozens of high school classmates and college classmates that I interviewed, very few, if any, of them saw what was burning inside him. Mm-hmm. They saw him as easygoing, laid back, smart, adaptable, someone that they admired for his ability to sort of negotiate the difficulties of high school and college without seeming to break out even in a sweat. Hmm. He was a fun guy who smoked dope and did an impersonation of Mick Jagger and played basketball and but inside,
I bet I'd like to see someday that image.
Me too.
That would be fun. Yeah.
They said he had the strut and the voice and the whole thing down. Which, I wish I could have seen a Saturday Night Live version of that one, if not the real thing.
Yeah.
In all those ways, the friends around him couldn't see what was going on inside, which was this struggle to find out, who am I? You know, am I black? Am I white? Where do I belong?
You know, the fact that he not only smoked marijuana, but was kind of a leader in that little band of Choom gang members, why hasn't that been a bigger deal? I mean, obviously, 20 years ago with your big book on Bill Clinton that won the Pulitzer, the smoking marijuana was such an issue in that campaign. This has been, it's created hardly a ripple, this notion that he was a card-carrying member of the Choom gang.
Well, first of all, times have changed.
Yeah, absolutely.
President Clinton claimed that he never inhaled, and Barack Obama said, well, that was the point, wasn't it? So, maybe some of the reaction to Clinton was that he was trying to play it both ways,
yeah,
and Obama
right.
never tried to back away from it. But in the culture of Honolulu in the late 1970s, there was nothing out of the ordinary about his life or even being part of a Choom gang, which was not a gang, but just a group of boys who liked to play basketball and smoke dope. People can make of that what they want. I'm just telling the story that was part of his life then.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Bruce from Kansas City, Missouri. Bruce, you're on Up to Date with David Marinus. Good morning.
Hey, David, how are you? And Steve,
good,
as always, you run an excellent show, and I'm getting ready to go to Amazon.com and order this book.
Okay.
Now, here's my question.
Yeah.
Here's my question. Former Vice President Dick Cheney and Barack Obama, there was a story out that they are distant cousins. Did you find that to be the case, or has that even been asked of you?
We're all distant cousins, man. So the answer is yes. Genealogists have traced that. I don't know what it is, eighth cousins, something removed or whatever. But as I said, you can find we're all related in some sense or another. So I do have a line in the book about Obama's genealogy and what part of it is Scots-Irish or French or or whatever, and that the Luo, the tribe in Kenya where his father came from, claimed that he's 100% Luo because it's a patriarchal society. So, you'll find a lot of oddities in the relationships between people in the United States, and somehow you'll find a connection with almost everyone.
Well, Bruce, let me just read you this from factcheck.org. Our producer, Stephen Steigman, has just popped this up for me. They share the same great, 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 great grandparents, a 17th century Massachusetts couple named Samuel Hinckley and Sarah Sewell Hinckley. How's that?
There you go.
No wonder they get along so well together.
Yeah, exactly.
Bruce, thanks for the good call. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
I don't think he's related to Romney, but one thing that Obama and Romney have in common is that neither of their fathers were born in the United States.
Oh, that's interesting.
George Romney was born in Mexico and Barack Sr. in Kenya.
How was George then able to run for president as a former governor of Michigan? How did that work for him?
Well, there's a lot of
fine-tuning
constitutional arguments about what qualifies someone. I mean, both his parents were American citizens who came from Utah, so mm-hmm. I don't think there was a problem.
Well, Barack Obama had a pretty frustrating career on a very good high school basketball team. Why was it so frustrating for him, David?
Well, he claimed in his memoir that it was he didn't start. He made the team as a senior, and he in his memoir, which is sort of drawn through the lens of race, he says that he played a sort of black style of basketball and his coach coached quote-unquote white style. My findings pretty much debunked that whole theory. He was a very good basketball player, and just to make the team required a lot of talent and persistence on his part. But
he had no hops, David.
No, he couldn't jump.
Couldn't jump.
You know, the stereotype of white versus black, he was on the white side of that stereotype. Mm-hmm. They called him Barry Obama with a no-jump jump shot. And many of the players on the team could dunk the ball, and he couldn't. They were noted for their pregame warm-ups where they'd do dunks and try to intimidate the other team, and Obama wasn't part of that. So, and they played a fast-break style of basketball. The coach liked to model himself after a combination of North Carolina and UNLV. So there was nothing to that except for the fact that Barry Obama didn't start and he wanted to.
Mm-hmm. And so he was frustrated by it. How did he deal with that frustration?
Well, he was not a bad teammate. His teammates thought that he put a lot of effort into the practices and made everybody on the team better,
mm-hmm.
Along with several other players who didn't start, including one of his classmates, Darren Mauer, couldn't start for Punahou and then played at Stanford as a walk-on, mm-hmm. In a good Division I school. So there was a lot of talent there. And Obama loved basketball. It really was central to understanding him. And the first entree he had into sort of African-American culture was basketball. You know, his heroes were Julius Erving, Dr. J, and Tiny Archibald and other black players. And it really was a way for him to learn about black culture through that sport. And he kept playing long after Punahou. There's one funny story where when he was running for president, or right after he'd been elected, he went back to his old prep school in Honolulu, and they rounded up many of the guys from that state championship team to have a pickup game. And Daryl Gabriel, who was the star of the team when they were in high school, after playing with Obama, said, "Man, Barack is a lot better player than Barry ever was." Because he stayed in shape and the other guys, were just middle-aged guys by that point.
Well, he still makes a big deal about shooting hoops whenever he shows up somewhere.
He does.
Well, on the final page of this book, you say that no life could have been more the product of randomness than his. Meaning what?
Well, think about, a Kenyan student meeting a young American who just arrived in Honolulu, both at the University of Hawaii, in a Russian class, having a brief encounter, and that creating the President of the United States. The strands of the story from Kenya and Kansas, ending up in Hawaii, creating this figure. I mean, we're all you know, chaos theory is what defines human life in, to some degree, and we're all products of randomness. His just seems to have more of that than most.
And Nancy on line one wants to say, I don't know any smokers who are good athletes. And I guess Barack Obama, does he still struggle with that, David?
Well, you know, that's not true. And in the old days, I wrote a book about the Green Bay Packers of the 1960s, and they had ashtrays. They had ashtrays in the locker room. So they all smoked, and that was so did baseball players back in the day. So, I mean, obviously it has a deleterious effect on all of us, as we know, but smoking does not inhibit immediate athletic performance as much as you might think. Or if it does, people still do it. And of course, you know, in Washington, D.C., I live next to the ballet school, and you see all these young ballerinas smoking to keep their weight down, which is kind of discouraging, but also part of that life.
You know, your career is so interesting to me because you've sort of gone back and forth in your writing between these great politicians who have ascended so far and sports figures like the great Clemente or Vince Lombardi, the great Green Bay Packers coach. Tell us about your journey and why you've sort of gone back and forth like that.
Well, you know, some people would say that it's like going from something serious to the toy department, and I don't look at it that way at all. I think that actually a lot of politics can be trivial, and that some sports can be very revealing and illuminating in terms of American culture and sociology. So when I'm looking for a book, only two things are important. One is that the character that I'm writing about interests me and that there's a sort of a narrative arc to the story that I can see. And secondly, that it can, you know, I can learn something about American life and culture or the global life and culture through that story. Whether it's, I mean, I happen to love sports and I'm interested in the forces that shape people and political forces of that sort. So those two subjects come to me naturally, and they both tend to have narrative arcs because they involve, to a superficial sense, winning and losing and a lot of competition and drama. So all of that adds to why I choose those subjects.
You know, when it comes to Clemente and as a kid who grew up, you know, watching him and being so aware of his greatness, I've always had in my own mind this sort of glow around the name Roberto Clemente and almost
I'm
as
glad
if
he, to hear that.
Almost like a saintly kind of figure. That's a little bit much, but yeah. was he all of that?
Well, I mean, that's why I wanted to write about
him.
He was
sure.
Even though I grew up in Madison with the Milwaukee Braves of Hank Aaron, I thought Clemente was the coolest thing I'd ever seen,
sure.
Just the way he looked. And that was before I knew what kind of person he was. Now, he wasn't a saint, but he was that rare athlete who was growing as a human being as his talents were diminishing. You know, he died nobly trying to deliver humanitarian aid to Nicaragua.
On New Year's Day, right?
There.
New Year's Eve,
On New Year's Day, New Year's Eve, 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very proud, passionate Puerto Rican who had to overcome both the language and skin color to prevail in Pittsburgh, the quintessential blue-collar working-class steel town.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of elements there that I think make him a person who's interesting above and beyond his skills on the baseball field, which were immense.
And it was so perfect that he had just gotten his 3,000th hit prior to his passing.
Yeah, I mean, that was his last hit.
Yeah.
And, you know, he sort of became a saint by the way he died, you know. And in Puerto Rico and all the Spanish-speaking world, you know, baseball players, like most athletes, tend to not know much about the past, but every Latino ball player knows the story of Roberto Clemente.
Well, David, we're out of time, but I sure appreciate you taking some time with us. I really enjoyed the book, and best of luck in your next volume on Barack Obama.
Steve, thanks. This was great to talk
with you. All the best, David.
Okay,
that's David Moranis. He's an associate editor at the Washington Post. His new book is titled Barack Obama, The Story. You can learn about our guest and get more information about our show at kcur.org. Well, sad news from Mayberry this morning. Andy Griffith passed away at his home in Dare County, North Carolina. He was, of course, the namesake of the greatest show in television history, at least in my view. A lot of folks know that about me. Here's our tribute to Andy Griffith.
Well, now take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. We may not get a bite all day, but don't you rush away. What a great place to rest your bones, and mighty fine for skipping stones. You'll feel fresh as a lemonade, setting in the shade. Whether it's hot, whether it's cool, oh, what a spot for whistling like a fool. What a fine day to take a stroll and wander by the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day. We'll have no need to call the roll when we get to the vision hole. There'll be you, me, and old dog Trey to doodle time away. If we don't hook a perch or bass, we'll cool our toes in dewy grass, or else pull up a weed to chaw and maybe set and jaw. Hanging around, taking our ease, watching that hound a-scratching at his flea. Come on, take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day.
That's Andy Griffith. He died this morning at 86. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.